Welcome to the Driving Eureka podcast, where we share ideas and advice for helping you find, filter, and fast track big ideas. Let's go! Hi, I'm Trip Babbitt, advisor to global organizations on the Deming philosophy and host of the Deming Institute podcast.
And I'm Doug Hall, inventor, speaker, teacher, and whiskey maker. I'm also the founder of the Eureka Ranch and author of the Driving Eureka book.
This is episode 25 of the Driving Eureka podcast. You can learn more about this episode by reading Doug Hall's newsletter at DougHall.com. In the menu, you can see newsletter, click on it, and you can subscribe. So Doug, trust this week. It's funny, I've just been interviewing some folks for a neuroscience podcast, and that this is one of the big topics, especially around neuroscience and how people gain trust in an organization, some of the things that happen, and how the brain works. That's kind of, and we've touched upon some of these things before about fight or flight type of scenario for people when the fear strikes them, and we've definitely talked about fear. So, in trust, what you're talking about this week seems to be how leadership and trust and trusting their team. So, let's get into this a little bit. Talk to me about what you're seeing in leadership and why they don't trust their teams.
Well, I think when you get to the root cause, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, you know, almost 50 years from when I did my first invention in years of consulting. And, you know, the premise that you'd innovate so to grow sales and profits, people will buy into that concept. But at the root cause of why leaders don't sort of put their weight behind it, their time, energy, and money behind it, I think at the root cause of the issue is they don't trust that their people can actually innovate successfully, that they can do it. And this lack of trust in their people doing it creates a chain reaction of bad behaviors. Hmm. You know, because they don't trust their teams that they can do big ideas, they say, well, let's just do some small ideas. Okay. The problem is the small ideas are, you know, not enough of a change to matter. And so they don't have enough wow factor. So the small ideas fail because small ideas fail. You know, people think, well, if I do a small idea, it's a higher odds of success. The answer is no. That's not what the facts say. It's just a smaller loss when you do them. But the odds are about the same, actually. And when they fail on the easy ideas, they lose confidence. So then they eventually turn around and they go, let's go get a guru. Let's get a design, blah, 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 whatever, to come do it. And they come up with these fancy ideas, a lot of marketing smoke and mirrors, but not being connected to the reality of how the actual service is delivered or the nonprofit or the product or whatever it is delivered. Those ideas soon fail. And so management turning around and saying, okay, we can't do big ideas. I can't do small ideas. The guru ideas don't work. Clearly, we can't innovate, or our industry can't innovate, or whatever dimension, whatever excuse they wrap themselves up in. So then they go to what seems to be the practical and prudent thing to do, which is to cost cut their way to growth. And this, you know, initially works, but soon hits diminishing returns until soon they're replaced and the cycle begins again. I mean, this is the way it happens. And it started because the leader didn't trust in the ability of the company teams to innovate.
You know, there's a lot to unpack here, first of all, because one of the things that I find in working with leadership teams is usually that's a reflection of themselves. In other words, they don't trust themselves. They don't have, from a leadership perspective, once you start digging into it, you know, these are people that they hired into their system. And then to kind of back off and not trust their teams really is a reflection on that leadership team as far as being able to do it.
I'm going to give them more sympathy. I'm going to have a lot more sympathy for them than that.
Okay.
I just don't think that they've ever been taught a way to do it.
That I would agree with. Yep.
And so, ignorance of how to do it, ignorance of a discipline system, ignorance of a discipline system, of investing in the systems. We have all these huge systems for finances. We have all these huge systems now for manufacturing. But we don't have real systems in place. We have a lot of judgments, the criteria things have to hit, but the systems to enable innovation, until we started with innovation engineering and started to put together the courses. I mean, we're really the first course ever that teaches you how to create, communicate, and commercialize ideas. There's no other field of study that does that. I mean, there's people that do design thinking at the front end. There's people that do engineering. And there's people that do marketing and finance, but to take you from idea to the market, it's the first integrated system that teaches you a mindset, which is all based on applying the work of Dr. W. Edwards Deming of systems thinking, approaching innovation as a system of interconnected parts, just as he changed manufacturing from a departmental silos to a system of interconnected parts. And people can do this, but they need to be trained and they need to learn. They need to learn. And so what we're finding is as we go in and we talk this and we say, you need to learn. They go, I got it. And they say, well, how can we learn? Well, we've got a course. You can take it on campus for credit. You can take it off campus. You can go online. You can do in person. I've got books. I've got a 10-hour audiobook. Driving Eureka, you can listen to. Well, I don't know. That seems like an awful lot. What we're finding is, under the leadership of Maggie Nichols, the CEO of the ranch, is we're finding that the best way for them to build trust is to do what we call a Eureka Inventing Project in collaboration with their people. In other words, walk the talk with them. All the talking's not going to do it. You got to actually get your hands on and do it. And when they can see that their teams can actually create, communicate, and start the process of accelerating it to market faster than ever before, they then start to build the trust. So they don't trust because they've never seen it happen before, but it can't happen because there's no method by which to do it. And so you're in this crazy do loop. And so you have to just get started and you have to just get a proof of concept that we can do it. You just have to do it. I mean, no more talk. No more debate, just do it, as our friends at Nike say.
So, Doug, when I agree, if you have method, that certainly breeds trust in an organization. But then, I also look at, and curious as to your view on this, where you have an organization that has, we talked about fear before. You've got, they're almost... They're so command and control within their organization, or they don't inquire about anything. Everything is about advocacy. You got to do it this way and make sure they're following the process type of thing. Versus, I watched a documentary last night on Pixar, where John Lasseter had these teams and they're putting together Toy Story and they're putting together all these different movies, and then they did after they've had. Four great successful movies with Bug's Life and Toy Story and Monsters, Inc. They bring in a guy named David Day that John Lasseter had worked before. And instead of people going, oh, no, we know everything because we've done it, they embrace this guy as he comes in with new thinking. So from my perspective, I see this almost spectrum of things for an organization that really – so command and control, so much fear, little
trust.
Yeah,
but how do you get, Trip, how are you going to stop that? How are you going to stop
it? Well, that's my question to you.
You're not going to stop it. So you have to, I think you have to ignore all of that because you can quickly get in. Of course the organization screwed up. Of course the system screwed up. Of course it is. It's a hopeless bureaucracy. That's why they're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But the only thing I can think of is you have to run to daylight. You got to find them a way that they can win. And so, just like we enable an individual in their sphere of influence, you've got to enable that they can win. Now, and I'm not in delusion land here. You've been doing it as many times as I've done. I'm not going to tell you that you do one idea, a miracle happens, and they're going to do it. No, sometimes you got to do it a dozen times before they believe, because they'll come up, okay, well, yeah, you did it this time, but that was because of this. Hmm. Okay, fine. Okay, let's do it again. Okay, we do it again. We do it again. Do it again. Nobody's against innovation. At their heart of hearts, nobody's against it. They're not against the idea of innovating. What they're against is actually doing it, because they don't know how, and they need to be done. And it's not enough to teach them. It's not enough to preach them. It's not enough to cajole them. It's not enough to debate it. You got to get your hands dirty and do it. And the problem I have with most innovation gurus is they don't know how to ship. They don't know how to ship. They've never gone from idea to market. And unless you've done that a dozen times, then it's very, very hard for you to sympathize with the operations people, the finance people, the sales people, and all the rest of it, of all of the things. We don't need more freaking ideas. We need people that know how to ship and play the trade-offs and the gyrations that have to happen. I mean, it's really hard, you know, which is why I love having the whiskey business, because it makes it so real, even to the ranch team, who is used to shipping, because we ship software and education courses. I mean, we have to go to market. We have customers and people that we have to ship those products. So they get it in a, you know, in the new economy way, digital and training and that kind of stuff. But shipping physical product and getting approval from the TTB and then the insurance companies and then the, oh, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, head blows up. Okay, but you got to learn how to deal with this. Keeping an operations plant running, maintaining quality, reducing variation in the process. I mean, this is the stuff that successful entrepreneurs, the devil's in the details. And when we get people engaged this way, that's when they start to trust. That's when they start to trust, because then they can see the organization engaged. And it's the only way. It's the only way. No amount of preaching is going to do it. No amount of teaching, no four-day seminar. It's not going to make the change. Oh, it will make it with about 10 or 15%. If you look at the diffusion of innovation curves, 10 or 15% you can get. But to the vast majority, you're going to get nothing.
So it's the emphasis on the doing.
You've got to make it real. If you don't make it real, and the problem is that making it real, it's inherently risky. I mean, to the outside person, if you're a consultant or an internal person, it's like, well, we failed at this for 10 years. And what makes you think you can solve it? Well, the reality is that we have methods that make a significant difference in getting you to look at ideas and see ideas and accelerate them differently than otherwise. We can test faster, cheaper. We can fail faster. We can inspire more. I mean, there are other methods. I mean, I'll never forget the chief marketing officer of one of the biggest companies in America brought his team to the Eureka Ranch. And we were talking and we were out at the bar that we have at the ranch, the Brain Brew bar. And he said, Doug, okay, I got to tell you the truth. He said, the reason I came here this week is because, management's decided to shut this down. And I was like, well, let's see if the ranch can do it. If they can't do it, there's nothing. So I came here. We've already got a death sentence. And this was the last gasp, and the team doesn't know it. And I said, so what are you thinking? He says, I'm going back to fight for it. He says, we can save this thing. And sure enough, they did. They saved the thing. They made an acquisition, and it's a big business right now. Confidentiality prevents me from saying the name, but it's a one that people would know, because we were like the last gasp, because when we do it and, you know, you're kind of annoyed that he would do such a thing, but at the same time, you're proud that he, you know, he said, if he failed, I was okay with it, because I'm like, geez, I don't like it when somebody says I'm okay if you fail. That irritates me. I had that happen again recently on another one. They say, Doug, it's okay if it doesn't work. It's like, what do you mean it's okay if it doesn't work? That's okay with me.
Yeah, no, that's good. It's time now for the Driving Eureka book segment with author and inventor, Doug Hall. Well, let's continue this conversation in the Driving Eureka book segment, where you're talking about creating an innovation culture, and that, and your lesson four, as you put in your newsletter, is absolute conviction.
Yeah. Yeah. So this came from an interview with Bill Conway, the former CEO of Nasher Corporation, who was the first Fortune 500 leader to embrace the system thinking of Deming. And as I sat with him and talked, you got a real sense of absolute conviction. He was 84 at the time. He's since passed. And his absolute belief in the power of systems thinking was still clear and very persuasive. He said, you can't dip your toe in. You got to jump all the way in. You got to do it. You can't hold back. And so when we get those leaders to that point where they believe, there's a certain point where I have a conversation. I said, okay, now it's time to go all in. Now it's time to go all in. Now is the time. Let's go. And some are ready, some are not. But when the senior leader says, we're doing it, and that's it, it creates an alignment and it creates a belief and it has an echo effect that energizes the organization. So in the beginning, you got a few pioneers who are doing something amazing and they're fighting against the world. And then you get more people through the system, you know, production, manufacturing, all that, believing, sales, believing in it. And as you get to that belief, you get to a certain tipping point, and then the leader, to create a culture, if you wanted now this to go from an episodic event to a cultural dimension, the leader has to have absolute conviction.
That makes sense. Is there an inflection point then where they have to be all in? I mean, where do you look for that, or is it different by organization?
Well, it's different by organization, and some of them have lead times that are massive. You know, I mean, I'm working with a drug company right now, and we're looking at a clinical for an experimental thing that we think is pretty cool. Well, this is going to be 18 months to do the clinical study. Okay, so this has got a long burn to it. You know, and while we can have some indications and we're optimistic, it's an 18-month burn to see if we can win in the clinical. So it's it's going to take a lot longer. In other cases, you can do it quicker.
But getting the buy-in, what are the criteria then that where you're going to have to say, okay, it's time to be all in? I guess I'm trying to look for a little bit more of a meaning around what you mean by all in.
When there's an urgency, when the teams are starting to say, okay, we've compartmentalized. So people will compartmentalize. They'll say, okay, you people do the innovation. You people don't innovate, or I'll say, you don't think anymore, okay? You just keep doing what you're doing. Okay. And suddenly the people that are innovating, you know, are running into friction and friction and friction. And the other people are saying, well, why don't we get to innovate too? Mm-hmm. And there's a certain point where there is it's a groundswell across the organization that causes this. It's the organization that becomes engaged in it. And you can feel it. I mean, you can feel it in the organization. They're ready to go. They're ready to go. A simple sign is people are quitting because it's not changing, and they're deciding they can go do something else.
Interesting. That's it's funny. I see different things, but kind of the same types of inflection points when I'm redesigning an organization. There comes a point where, well, you always have, especially if you start with a team, as you say, you guys go with the willing when you're working with an organization to start with. And then some of the people around it that weren't necessarily the willing, but they may not have been fully out either. They want to become a part of that because they see them doing fun things. I mean, it looks like a lot of fun for what you're doing. So It seems to be when people start to see that there's some momentum around something, how do I become a participant? So that's one of the criteria, at least I'm hearing, that you look for when you start to hear somebody say, hey, how do we begin to participate? And then that is one of the indicators then that takes you to the leader. Is that
sure?
Okay.
Sure.
Yep. Okay. Very good. This is the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy podcast, where we will take you behind the scenes so you can see what it takes to build a whiskey distillery business. The Eureka Ranch team, led by Doug Hall, are creating a craft whiskey company with patented technology like has never been done before. Well, let's move to our Brain Brew Whiskey Academy. Absolute trust comes from your product, not marketing. I love this one as far as the message that's here around the role of marketing versus, you know, the role of a repeat customer.
So if you're in the craft spirits business or any business, marketing will get you your first purchase. But repeat purchases are driven by, is the product awesome? And frankly, that first purchase, you usually lose money on it because the marketing expense for that first purchase. Your profits come from product, not from marketing. I'm sorry, marketing people. I know you think you're God's gift to the corporation, but nobody repeat buys marketing. Okay. It's just the thing that gets the attention. You're just a trial generating device. And don't give me the foo-foo on this, because otherwise what you're going to end up with, you know, what happens in the craft business is there's a whole lot of people that sell products as a one and done. You know, it's a souvenir of visiting the distillery. They're such nice people. I love what they're doing here. Their spirit's good. Product's not really that good, but here, this is the least bad one. I'll buy one of those and just to support them. And now they've got a tourism trinket. It's a souvenir. It's not a product that's consumed. And what I want is a product that's consumed, which is why I love blind tests. I love blind tests where there's no marketing with it, because it's just straight up, is my product awesome or not? No spin movement on it, no hype on it, just straight up, is this product awesome? I mean, that's what you want to do. And in fact, this is the problem. I mean, the American Craft Spirits Association did a survey a couple of years ago, poor product quality, one of the very top issues associated with what was holding back craft spirits. Products aren't good. The products aren't good. The product isn't great. It's not great. It's got to be better. The beer guys, the craft beer guys, had more flavor than the Budweisers. They brought something new to the party. The craft spirits people, if we're not careful, I know you love your vodka, but it's going to be really hard to get anybody to give a damn about your vodka. Make your cocktail with three different vodkas and tell me you can tell the difference. I challenge you. Make your gin and tonic with most gins, and your, except for if you don't have juniper or not. It's not going to be that different by the time you put all that sugar in it. Now, make your whiskey unique, really unique. Use finishing, use different methods to really make it unique. Push the grains way to different places. Change the way you do your aging, because 70% of the flavor comes from the wood. Manage the wood. And now make a cocktail. And one of the things we do is we'll make four old fashions with our four core products. And then we'll also make the old fashioned with vodka. And it's five different experiences. Five totally different experiences because of the amount of flavor and the way that we're doing it, because we purposely make our stuff taste different. So you got to have product. Product first, then marketing. That's my view. Starts with the product. You got to have amazing product. And the industry of the spirits world tends to be less on product. I was at the wholesaler show down in Orlando, and they had brand battle where people came out and they talked blah, blah, blah about their brand. And the amount of conversation about the product was about 5%. And I'm like, it doesn't work for me. Is the product awesome? One guy actually said, well, yeah, we're doing it. And we've got a bourbon. You know, it's a good bourbon, like everybody's bourbon. He literally admitted he had a commodity. I'm like, if I had a button, I'd have hit the button and he would, you know, be like Bugs Bunny. He would have gone through the floor.
So
I'm sorry. I'm ranting. No. I'm just getting tired of this marketing BS that's going on. Oh, fancy bottle, fancy package, fancy this. We got bottles that cost more than the juice. Bottles and cap, label, cost more money than the whiskey inside the bottle. That's ridiculous. Ridiculous. I mean, that's why I love Tito's. He puts it in the product, not in the package. Something to be said for that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Obviously, you know, since we started these conversations, I really didn't know that much about whiskey. You've taught me everything, really, I've learned to this point about whiskey. But as I've gotten into it, now I still haven't tried your Relatively product that I know of, unless it was one of the samplings that I did one time. I was at the ranch or the Noble Oak. And then you've got the four new products. But one of the things I am finding is there are some whiskeys that I wonder, Doug, is it a matter of my palate that I just don't like that particular whiskey, or is there something more? I guess I haven't risen to the level of knowing what's good and bad. Now, I did have, I won't mention the name, but an Indiana whiskey, and there's not that many actually here in Indiana, but that are Indiana made, and I've tried a couple of them, and in my opinion, they were awful. I mean, they were just, I couldn't mix them with anything, and they tasted terrible straight up to me, and
they're bad. They're just bad products.
Yeah.
They're just bad products.
And so people then, as you see it, from what you're finding, is they're leaning more on the marketing than actually trying to get a product that's good. Kind of what you're seeing in that industry anyway?
That's right. They're not investing. Well, and the big problem, I mean, just really cutting to the chase. The big problem is they don't understand what whiskey is. Whiskey is made from wood, not from distilling. The distilling is 5 or 10% of it. Then it's the mash bill, and then it's the wood. I mean, the wood is 70% of the flavor. I mean, that's where the flavor comes from. 70% from the wood, 25% from which grains you use, and 5% is in the distilling. And they spend all their time on distilling as opposed to the wood, you know, and it's the wood and the wood maturation and how you manage that wood. That is it. And by the way, it's epically expensive, by the way. Mm-hmm. I mean, the problem with it is it's really expensive to have all these different woods and to be finishing them and to be having barrel. It's really expensive. It's really, really expensive. I mean, it makes the cost of the distillery look cheap by the time you have to get the barrels that you need, which is why systems like our time compression approach are critical for something like this, because we're able to do it much faster, much cheaper, and still getting the amazing tastes. But you have to manage wood. You've got to manage wood. And you have to be careful about it, because if you're not careful, like some people are using small barrels, thinking that helps. But you got to be really precise when you manage those. Because if you're not careful, what you'll end up with is a wooded new make spirit, meaning that you'll have a whole lot of oak in the product. It's like a donut, like the center of the donut, but it's wrapped around this harsh new make spirit because you haven't converted the alcohols, which is one of the things that has to happen through the aging process.
Interesting. So people are working on, in your view, in the whiskey industry, people are working on the wrong problem.
Well, they just don't understand.
Okay.
I mean, they just don't understand, and they don't understand that. I mean, they don't understand how whiskey is actually made.
Well, that would be a problem. then you would have to lean on marketing quite a bit. Then it becomes more expensive, obviously, to do that over time.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, let's move to our craft cocktail recipe. Now, we've had the jalapeno julep, I think was one of our earlier drinks that we had. This one is the mint julep. So
This is
a staple, though, isn't it? The mint julep is the one that they serve like at the Kentucky Derby and that type of thing, right?
Right. And coming up to Derby time, I thought it was a perfect time to do that and to get people prepared so that they can have one. Most mint juleps are horrific. And the three flaws are they have too much sugar, you know, and they use a lot of sugar when they have the wrong whiskey. And that's number two, is the wrong bourbon whiskey that they're using. And the three thing is not muddling with force. You really have to use real force when you do the muddling in order to make it work.
So how do you muddle with force?
You really take the muddler and press and press and press and press and press. And I really learned this down in the Dominican Republic with a mojito. There was a lady there who really just ground the, with a mortar and pestle, really did the mint. And after that, I was very impressed.
Okay. All right.
So it's really simple. Muddle really firmly. 5 mint leaves, 1 teaspoon of simple syrup. That's it, 1 teaspoon. Add some ice, crushed if you have it. 2 ounces of our Noble Oak bourbon, which you can get if you're looking for it. Go to Noble Oak Bourbon, Noble Oak Whiskey. Search it up on the internet. We can put it in the show notes. There's a product finder so that you can find it where you are. It's in most of the states now. Stir and enjoy with a sprig of mint as a garnish, and you got it. The classic mint julep. It's an elegant product. In fact, I think I got to have one of these tonight, I think.
I have never made one. So it's always a bourbon. So just a question I have for you, Doug, is one of the 4, your local Cincinnati whiskeys, is that a bourbon, or are they all more complex than that?
We have 2 bourbons, a rye, and a 4-grain whiskey.
Okay. So the bourbon would be the Keelboat?
No, it's Paddle Wheel.
Paddle Wheel. Okay.
Paddle Wheel, and then the smoked, the Tall Stacks.
The Tall Stacks, okay.
And Tall Stacks will give you a smoked julep, which is actually magnificent. So it's really cool.
But for this one, you prefer the Noble Oak then?
I just thought I'd mention Noble Oak.
Okay.
I just decided to use this one. This uses a sherry oak staves. So it's a little different taste. And I just thought I'd do this. I had a cool experience at the wholesaler conference. It was at the Ritz-Carlton down in Florida. I was in Nathan's, the big restaurant there, the big fancy restaurant.
I said,
do you have anything that's craft? I mean, you got all these big corporation stuff and, you know, Johnny, Jimmy and Jack and, you know, all these mega corporations that own those brands. You know, there's no people there anymore. And I said, do you have anything real craft? And Christine, the bartender, came over and she says, I have this thing here called Noble Oak. We really love it. We just got a bottle of it and the staff all loves it. And I go, yeah, I know what that is. So she made me a wonderful cocktail and we had a great talk about it. And I had everybody over there and I put it up on, I just snapped a picture and put a little thing on LinkedIn and it's got almost 50,000 views.
It's wow. Like,
it's crazy. Yeah. It's crazy. But it was awful nice to be, you know, and she hadn't heard any of the marketing or the hype or the rest of the stuff. And she just said, I like the taste. And again, it's product. Product wins. Product wins.
Very good. All right. Any parting words for our Brain Brew Whiskey Academy?
No, the big thing is, folks, make products that you love, okay? Don't make crappy products, and don't ship crappy products. And I know the industry, you want to make everything yourself. The fact of the matter is in the history of whiskey, the biggest whiskey people pre-prohibition were blenders who would take the whiskey from different people and put it together. That's an honorable profession, being a whiskey maker. Remember, the whiskey maker, the person who takes the barrels or puts it together, or if you're working with us where you choose your wood bill and put it together, the whiskey maker is the higher paid employee versus the distiller. The whiskey maker gets paid 65% more than the distiller. This isn't beer, it's whiskey. And in the world of whiskey, the talents bring it together. And if you don't know how to do that, come see us. We'll teach you. We'll teach you how to do it.
Very good. And for the consumer, don't settle.
No, crappy. Don't buy the souvenir when you go visit them. Don't buy the souvenir. Tell them, you know, don't buy a bottle and just have it sit as a souvenir. We need to help everybody and we need to fight for great products. We got to get everybody making great products.
Because we appreciate you as a listener, we are offering for a limited time 4 things. A 1-hour abridged audio of the Driving Eureka book. a subscription to the Driving Eureka newsletter, which contains weekly advice from Doug Hall on how to find, filter, and fast track big ideas. And the newsletter has other offers that are not made public. The Driving Eureka prescription for success: you answer questions and we'll help you assess your ability to find, filter, and fast track big ideas. And you get advice on how to grow your ability to innovate. And the last item, access to a Doug Hall interview with a radio legend. To get these offers, go to www.doughall.com/podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to the Driving Eureka podcast on iTunes.